Dengar glared at the Kanithian. When Senthenanan ran this business, he knew that his customers weren't just buying a message being transmitted, they were also buying him keeping his mouth shut.
You're not dealing with Senthenanan, no.
The bright gaze behind the magnifying lens was unperturbed.
You're dealing with me and my backers. I'm not a completely independent agent the way Senthenanan was, but then that may be why he's dead and I'm not. Let's just say that I have certain additional expenses that I need to cover.
The tip of the lens pointed toward Dengar.
For which you should be grateful.
Yeah, I'm grateful, all right. Dengar shook his head in disgust. That was the problem with doing business in Mos Eisley. There were always payoffs that had to be made, bribes in either the form of credits or information. And he was effectively tapped out of credits. That left only one thing to barter. You want to know why Kuat would be interested? I'll tell you. It's because he just made one hell of an effort to make sure that Boba Fett was dead. Did word of that bombing raid out on the Dune Sea reach here?
Of course it did,
said the Kanithian.
The seismic shocks had structural beams cracking all over Mos Eisley. Really? The Imperial Navy cannot engage in a routine practice operation such as that and not have sentient creatures notice it.
It wasn't the Imperial Navy. It was a private operation.
Oh? And what proof do you have of that?
Dengar reached inside his jacket for the large, heavy object he'd found near his main hiding place in the desert. Back there, he'd brushed the sand off the device, a dully gleaming sphere, and had read the words and serial numbers incised upon its thick armored shell. Reading those words and realizing what they meant had changed all his plans in an instant. They were why he was here in the Mos Eisley Cantina talking to a message expediter like this Kanithian. That hadn't been part of Boba Fett's plans for this little errand into the spaceport. Dengar was operating on his own now. He shoved the sphere with its two off-center cylindrical protrusions toward the Kanithian. Take a look. It's an atmospheric phase change detonator for an Imperial-class M-12 sweep bomb. Dengar set the sphere down between them. This one's a dud. These particular detonation devices have a failure rate in the field approaching almost 10%. That's why the Imperial Navy doesn't use them anymore. They've upgraded to a more reliable gravity wave system that's integrated into the main explosives casing. It's not removable like this thing. That should have been your first clue that it wasn't the Empire doing a practice bombing run out there in the desert. The Kanithian prodded the sphere with the tip of the magnifying lens.
I'll grant you, for the sake of your exposition, that this is not an Imperial device, but I fail to see the connection between it and Kuat of Kuat.
Check it out. Dengar held the sphere up to the lens. Serial numbers. All these devices were manufactured at one armory subcontractor, which has ties to the Kuat Drive Yard's engineering facilities. The devices were numbered sequentially in production runs of 250,000. All the ones numbered below the 12 million mark were reserved for KDY's own use, designing and testing. Dengar tapped the tiny incised number with his fingertip. This is one of those devices. Obviously, KDY decided there would be a use someday for some major bombing action. The company didn't get to be the leading shipbuilder for the Empire by just underbidding its competition, you know. So it held some bombs and fuses back after all the testing on the Imperial ships was finished. If this one had gone off like the others, nobody would have known who had made that bombing run out on the Dune Sea.
Interesting.
The Kanithian's beady gaze flicked from the sphere to Dengar's face.
Perhaps there is reason to believe that Kuat of Kuat wishes Boba Fett dead.
If Fett is alive at all.
But that leaves many other questions unanswered.
They'll have to remain unasked, too, for the time being. Dengar tucked the metal sphere back inside his jacket. I don't have time to give you a full rundown on everything that's happened out there. The Kanithian shook his head.
There's one question that I still must ask now. You wish to inform the rich and powerful Kuat of Kuat that despite all his efforts to the contrary, Boba Fett yet lives.
When Kuat comes and finds you, as he undoubtedly will, and as I presume is your intention that he should, then what?
Dengar remained silent. That's a good question, he thought to himself. One that he'd been working on during a whole long trip from the Dune Sea into Mos Eisley. A dangerous question as well, since he was now sneaking around behind the back of one of the deadliest individuals in the galaxy. If Boba Fett were to find out that he was being two-timed, which was what contacting Kuat of Kuat amounted to, then Dengar's life wasn't worth the smallest coin in the pouch inside his jacket. Still, mused Dengar, I've got to look out for myself. Fett's offer of a partnership between the two of them still worried him. Now that Boba Fett had just about recovered completely from his time in the Sarlacc's gut and had gotten nearly all of his old strength and skills back, how long would he have any use for another bounty hunter cutting in on his action? So, it's all a matter, he told himself again, of who sells out the other first. And as a purchaser, somebody as rich and powerful as Kuat of Kuat had some definite advantages, not only in terms of the price that could be paid, but also in the protection he could give. It had only been a fluke that the bombing raid hadn't reduced Boba Fett to dust and disconnected atoms. The next effort that Kuat made would be even more severe. I could get the credits, thought Dengar, and there would be nothing that Boba Fett could do about it, because he'd be dead. The shining bead eyes of the Commithian seemed to have read his thoughts.
It's a dangerous game you are playing.
I know that. Dengar slowly nodded his head. But it's the only one I've got. There were a few more details to settle, and he and the Commithian took care of them. Dengar knew that Boba Fett was planning on getting off Tatooine. That would make it difficult, if not impossible, for Kuat of Kuat to get back in touch with the sender of the message about Fett still being alive. So the Commithian would also act as the contact point. That meant he would also get a cut of whatever payment Kuat made for the necessary information of Boba Fett's whereabouts. Dengar moved up the short flight of steps that led to the street level outside. From the doorway's arch, he could see across the heads of the crowd all the way back to the booth where he had left the Commithian. Even if he hadn't been in shadow, the Commithian's weak eyesight would have ruled out his being spotted as he watched and waited. Several minutes passed, and he didn't see the Commithian get up from the booth, and none of the other creatures in the cantina joined him there either. Dengar figured that was a good sign. If the Commithian was going to sell him out, stab him in the back by passing on the information about Boba Fett to some other interested party in the cantina, the creature would have done so immediately. That way some bunch of thugs could have jumped him before he'd had a chance to get out of Mos Eisley, then painfully extracted the other bounty hunter's location from him. Dengar turned and headed up the rest of the steps. A few seconds later, he was threading his way through the spaceport's dark alleys. He had one more errand to take care of, the one on which Boba Fett had sent him, before he could return to the hiding place by the Dune Sea. What Dengar hadn't seen was the little creature that inched its way down the metal support pillar of the booth's table, then started a slow, laborious crawl across the cantina's floor. Still no bigger in diameter than Dengar's hand, it had been thin as paper when it had surreptitiously emerged from the cloak of the Commithian's feathers. By the time the membrane organism had finished listening to the conversation between the two larger creatures in the booth, it had swollen pillow-like into the thickness of a humanoid finger joint. When it reached the booth on the farthest side of the cantina, a greasy black-nailed hand reached down and picked it up.
Fat little thing, ain't it?
Val Hamame had once been a member of a swoop gang. They had had a parting of the ways, and not an amicable one. Since then, Hamame had found other employment equally criminal.
Looks like the Knithen sent it over here, all stuffed with information.
What else?
Hamame's partner was equally villainous-looking. The mucus-lined pleats of his nasopharynx fluttered wetly with each breath.
That's what these things are for.
The membrane's tiny legs wriggled futilely as Fedroy flipped it onto its glistening back.
Look, see what it's got for us.
Hamame's jag-edged fingertip pressed down on the bulging center of the membrane. The stored energy converted back into sound. The two thugs listened to all of the deal that had gone down between Dengar and the Knithian.
Now that's interesting.
Hamame leaned back on his side of the booth.
That Knithian is a sneaky type, but he's earned its keep with this bit. So Boba Fett's still alive. That's one tough barf.
Fedroy gave an admiring shake of his head, the coarse and dirty ringlets of his beard scraping across his tunic collar.
You just can't kill him. If falling down a Sarlacc won't do the trick, then what will?
Hamame reached inside his jacket and pulled out his blaster. He pointed the muzzle up toward the cantina's ceiling.
This will.
It had taken a long time for Bossk to come into his own, to possess all that should have been his from the beginning, to be known as the toughest, hardest, most feared bounty hunter in the entire galaxy. He leaned back in the pilot's chair of the Hound's Tooth, savoring the pleasures that came with success. Mingled with a simmering anger, he'd had to wait until Boba Fett was dead, and that had been much too long in coming. A thread of regret mingled with the other emotions. He would have liked to have killed Fett himself. Now, that would have been a real pleasure. Some of the anger was replaced with self-pity. There were so many things of which he had been cheated in this life. The leadership of the Bounty Hunters Guild, that should have been his as well. Now, it could hardly be said that the Guild existed at all. Granted, a lot of personal satisfaction had come with the killing of old Kredosk, his father. That was the sort of thing that really defined the relationship between Trandoshan generations. But he hadn't gotten much material benefit out of the act. Instead of becoming the head of a galaxy-wide organization of predators, he'd wound up on his own, a scrabbling independent agent like all the other bounty hunters. That had been Boba Fett's doing. The breakup of the Bounty Hunters Guild had been a long time ago, before Bossk had learned one of the most important lessons in this business. Don't trust your competition. Kill them. So when the word had reached him that Boba Fett was dead, dissolved in the digestive secretions of the Sarlacc beast, a combination of elation and frustration had welled up inside him. But Bossk had set the Hound's Tooth at maximum speed for the too familiar planet of Tatooine, just to bask in the atmosphere that had been the last to fill his enemy's lungs. He didn't get that far, though. Before he'd had time to set landing coordinates for the Mos Eisley spaceport, Bossk had found something just as familiar, and even more intriguing, in autonomic orbit outside Tatooine's atmosphere. A simple hailing call had confirmed that the ship he'd spotted was the Slave One, and that it was empty, but still under the protection of its internal guard circuitry.
This is too good, Bossk had decided.
It was one thing to inherit by default the mantle of top bounty hunter in the galaxy, but to also stumble upon the late Boba Fett's personal ship, the repository of all his weaponry and databases, all the painstakingly acquired secrets and strategies that had put him at the top of this dangerous trade. Bossk couldn't resist an opportunity like that. He was smart enough to avoid trying to crack Slave One's security measures himself, but with Fett being dead, there was no time pressure about getting past the ship's circuits. Bossk had the credits and the leisure that allowed for calling in professional assistance. That was one advantage to being this close to Tatooine. Services of that kind were exactly the sort available in Mos Eisley. A harsh electronic buzz sounded from the Hound's comm unit. A message had been received. Undoubtedly the one for which Bossk had been waiting, he pulled himself closer to the cockpit's control panel and saw something that puzzled him for a moment. There were two messages waiting for him. The first was from the decrypt technician on Slave One, just as he had expected. The other had arrived almost simultaneously. A messenger pod sent straight from the surface of Tatooine. The coded message unit was from a Knithian message expediter with whom Bossk had a long-standing working arrangement. Bossk read the destination info off the unit. It was headed to the distant engineering center of Kuat,
to the head of Kuat Drive Yards, Kuat of Kuat. The Knithian had been correct in figuring that he would want to see this.
Anything, thought Bosk, that's being sent to someone as rich and powerful as Kuat is something that I'm interested in.
A successful bounty hunter always had to have his info sources open wide band, so he could filter through all the galaxy's secrets and rumors for the bits that might turn out to be profitable. He decided to read the encoded message unit later, after he had taken care of the other business, for which he had been waiting so long. The tip of his claw hit the next button on the cockpit's comm controls.
I'm all finished over here.
The recorded voice, dry and emotionless, was that of the lead technician for Decrypt Information Services, one of the many semi-legitimate businesses that abounded in Mos Eisley.
The security codes have been sieved out, and you now have full access to the ship designated as Slave One.
Bosk fired up the primary navigation engines and maneuvered the Houndstooth over to Slave One. He let the transfer connection between his own ship and the Slave One seal shut behind him. Warily, he stepped forward into Slave One's cargo hold. Grasping one of the rungs with his free hand, he climbed up into the cockpit and punched out a few quick commands on the ship's computer.
Those were credits well spent, decided Bosk.
When he saw the file directory appear on the screen in front of him, the decrypt technician had cracked and stripped out the password protection. All of Boba Fett's secrets lay there exposed, ready for his careful examination. Bosk reached out and blanked the computer screen. Going through all those files would take a long time. He'd have to bring over a MEM device from the Houndstooth so he could do a core dump and take everything back to his own ship to be sorted out at his leisure. It might take years.
But then,
Bosk smiled to himself,
I've got the time. And Boba Fett doesn't, not anymore.
Just outside the cockpit hatchway, Bosk saw a door, partly ajar. He saw now that it was cleverly constructed, the hinges concealed, and the door's edges the same dimensions as the surrounding bulkhead panel. Anyone who hadn't known of it would have had a hard time locating it. When the decrypt technician had scoured out the security systems, Bosk figured, the door's powered lock must have sprung open. The space he could see on the other side of the door was unlit. But only for a moment longer, a quick shot from his blaster lit up everything inside. The door now dangled loose. Bosk kicked it farther open. There was only one object in the enclosed space, a featureless, almost cubical shape. It stood nearly as tall as Bosk. A droid, an inert screen load shifter. Bosk recognized the variety as one used in engineering facilities and interstellar shipyards. Bosk wondered why a droid of this dull, uninteresting type was even here aboard the Slave One. The access hatch on the side of the droid was unlatched. Bosk pulled it open, bending his head to see inside. He unclipped a small electric torch from his belt and shone it around the container's interior. It was crowded with various pieces of linked equipment, spy equipment. Discrete surveillance gear was a familiar category in the bounty hunter's trade. Bosk recognized a full array of optical and auditory pickups, wired to micro-pinhole elements studying the droid's carcass. Bosk poked around some more inside the deactivated droid. If Boba Fett had been doing the same a while back, maybe before he'd gone down to Tatooine and hired on at Jabba the Hutt's palace, he must have been interrupted before he'd gotten very far. Most of the seals were still in place on the various bits of enclosed gear. When Bosk snapped one and peeled it off a circuit module, he made an interesting discovery. The corporate emblem of Kuat Drive Yards was embossed on the silvery metal ribbon dangling in his hands.
There's a coincidence, mused Bosk.
He knew it was more than that. The messenger pod that the Knithian and Mos Eisley had routed his way was supposed to go right into Kuat of Kuat's hands. Bosk's mercenary instincts were aroused by these overlapping signs of interest on the part of one of the galaxy's richest and most powerful creatures. The big question right now was what Kuat had been using this droid to spy on. Bosk poked some more in the droid's innards and found at last what he was looking for. The multi-track recording unit that had been connected to the various sensors. The only other object in this concealed chamber was a tripod-mounted holographic playback unit. Bossk sorted through the connectors until he found the one that matched up with the recorder. After a few seconds of format scanning, a miniaturized, fuzzy-edged landscape formed in front of Bossk. Some place on Tatooine. Bossk could tell that much just from the quality of light, the mingled shadows that came with the planet's twin suns. It looked like one of those miserable, dreary moisture farms that eked out a low-profit existence on the edges of the Dune Sea. Bossk could see ugly black smoke rising to the top of the hollow image as the shot's point of view moved in closer. The spy circuits in the droid must have felt it was all right to come out in the open, since every creature at the moisture farm was obviously dead.
Looks like a standard stormtrooper hit, he judged.
The silence of the recorded image was broken by the rising whir of a speeder approaching from somewhere in the distance. For a moment, the image's point of view tilted and bounced. Obviously, the spying droid had scrambled back to someplace in the surrounding dunes where it wouldn't have been spotted. The shot steadied at long distance, then zoomed forward as the spy circuit switched to a powerful telephoto lens that enabled Bossk to recognize at least the figure that had scrambled out of the speeder when it had come to a bobbing halt.
That's Luke Skywalker, he thought.
There was no mistaking that youthful human face and tousled blonde hair. He leaned closer to the image, suddenly fascinated by it.
This must be the stormtrooper raid,
Bossk slowly nodded.
On that moisture farm where Skywalker grew up.
Bossk drew back from the floating image, watching as Skywalker discovered the charred skeletons of the aunt and uncle who had raised him from childhood. He knew how much tighter those bonds of sentiment were for other species. He also knew about Luke Skywalker's ties to the Rebel Alliance. Rumors and stories had already spread throughout the galaxy, along with ID holos and other tracking data. This mere youngster, from an obscure backwater planet, had somehow become overwhelmingly important to Emperor Palpatine, and, perhaps even more so, to Lord Vader, the Empire's black-gloved fist. Vader's creatures, his personal legions of spies and informers, were still scouring all the inhabited worlds for leads on Skywalker. Why, though, was still a carefully guarded secret. The deactivated droid and its contents were now even more intriguing to Bossk. It might not provide Skywalker's current location, which would have been worth credits. Vader would pay for that kind of data. But there might be some kind of clue as to just why both the Emperor and the Dark Lord of the Sith were so interested in him. And to a smart barb like Bossk, that could be worth even more. Others might pay even more than Vader or Palpatine. Bossk mulled over the possibilities. After all, the droid with its carefully concealed surveillance equipment had all the appearances of having been put together by Kuat drive yards. Why would Kuat of Kuat have been interested in Skywalker? That would be something worth finding out as well. The image blinked out as Bossk reached inside the droid's cargo space and started disconnecting the circuits. He'd have a better chance of figuring out what the holographic recording meant if he took it back over to the Houndstooth and puzzled over it. One of the data leads surprised him. It was hooked up to an olfactory sensor on the droid's exterior. He could understand wanting to get a high-resolution visual and auditory record of the event, but why collect scent molecules in the air? The data cable was routed to an analyzer unit rather than the recording device. The unit had picked up something from the recording. Numbers and symbols flickered by as the device sorted out the possibilities. After a moment, the numbers slowed, then turned to letters, then to words. Pheromones detected. Another second passed before the rest appeared. Subtype sexual, gender male. Then the last. Species match. Faline. The words remained until Bossk blanked the screen with a press of his clawed thumb. That was even more interesting. Falines didn't serve in the Imperial Stormtroopers. The whole species was too congenitally arrogant to submit to military discipline. They were fearsome enemies, but strictly solo fighters. And there was one Feline in particular who had risen almost to the top in Palpatine's court. Prince Shizor had been perhaps the only one there who could get away with defying Lord Vader's commands, and Shizor was dead now. There had been even more to Shizor's defiance than the Emperor had been aware of, though rumors told of Vader having suspected the truth, that Prince Shizor had been, in fact, the secret head of the infamous Black Sun, the criminal organization that spanned the galaxy, an empire in its own right. Speculations raced inside Bossk's skull. Had Prince Shizor also been there on Tatooine when Vader's stormtroopers had raided the moisture farm at the edge of the Dune Sea, when Luke Skywalker's aunt and uncle had been killed? That was what the olfactory record in the droid spy circuits would indicate, but it didn't tell why Shizor would have been there. Or why Kuat of Kuat would have planted a surveillance system that would detect the evidence of Shizor's involvement. Or how Boba Fett had come to possess the spy recording. That many questions without answers made Bossk's head hurt as though it might explode from the pressure building within. "This is going to take some time to figure out," he thought grimly. He extracted the rest of the recording devices from the droid, stacked the metal boxes up in his hands, and turned back toward the secret chamber's doorway. Back aboard the Houndstooth, Bossk set the spy devices down beside a corner of the cockpit's main control panel. There was the other matter to check out, the encoded message unit that the Kenithian down in Mos Eisley had routed his way. Bossk was already wondering if there might be some connection between it and what he had just discovered aboard Slave One. He sat down at the cockpit controls and pulled the encoded message unit over to himself. The Kenithian had provided him with a simple bypass key and decryption protocol with which he'd be able to read the enclosed information, then seal up the message unit and send it on its way without the eventual recipient being able to tell that its security had been breached. Bossk extracted a single slip of flimsoplast from the unit. "That's it," he thought, feeling slightly disappointed. As he turned the slip over, he couldn't imagine that he'd find anything important on it. A moment later, Bossk came to. He found himself lying on the floor, a befuddled consciousness slowly seeping back into his brain. The pilot's chair was tilted backward from where he had toppled from it. With trembling claws, he plucked the flimsoplast from his chest. He held it up in front of his unwilling gaze. The same four words were still there, words that changed everything, that turned the universe inside out, expelling Bossk from its bright center. "Boba Fett is alive." He couldn't believe it, but at the same time, he knew it was true. It was always true. Fedroy used the muzzle of his blaster rifle to point over the top of the dune.
"There they are. We could probably take them all out right now."
Beside him, lying belly down in the sand, Hamaim shook his head.
"Nah, they're worth more alive than dead. Or at least Boba Fett is."
"All right."
Fedroy looked along his blaster rifle's barrel at the other figures in the night, then back to his partner.
"So, just what is it you're going to do?"
Hamaim stood up, his boots digging into the slope of the dune.
"Simple."
He smiled as he slung his blaster rifle's leather strap across his shoulder.
"I'm going to go down there and talk to them." "Well, here's a happy little gathering."
The man raised the barrel of his blaster rifle.
"Old friends like us really ought to try to get together more often."
"Val Hamaim," said Dengar with a sour grimace and a nod. "I thought I spotted you back there in Mos Eisley."
"You should have said hello. Then I wouldn't have had to follow you all the way out to this place."
Boba Fett looked over at Dengar. "Seems as though you didn't do a very good job of keeping things secret."
"Don't blame him," said Hamaim. "Let's just say I've got my contacts pretty well lined up in Mos Eisley. There's a whole galaxy out there that's heard you're dead. Some creatures, I don't know who, might be happy to hear you made it out. There's a whole bunch of others who would probably be a lot less than happy when they find that you're walking around again.
That's their problem. Fett gave a slight shrug. And it might be a while before they find out, anyway. Especially since you won't be telling them.
Hold it right there.
With one quick motion, Hamaim pushed Neela aside as his other hand swung the blaster rifle up into firing position. The shove was hard enough to send her sprawling onto her knees. He gestured at Boba Fett with the rifle's muzzle.
Get your hands up. Step away from that box.
This? Fett's hands were already level with his helmet. With the toe of his boot, he gave the comm unit a kick.
It's not even operational. I don't care if it's as dead as you're supposed to be.
A few lights had blinked on the control panel of the comm unit. Hamaim raised the muzzle of the blaster rifle higher, aiming from his hip straight toward Boba Fett's helmet.
I don't want any surprises.
Fett moved toward where Dengar was standing.
Careful, he said. You won't get nearly as much for a corpse as you will for living merchandise.
I'll take what I can get, said Hamaim.
Don't be an idiot. Dengar spoke up. If you want credits, just let us go, and we'll make it worth your while.
Hamaim shook his head with a grimace of disgust.
Get real. Whatever you two could pay for your hides isn't anything compared to what others would be willing to.
Neela lay on the ground where she had landed, keeping still as she listened to the exchange going on above. The man's choice of words tipped her off. Whatever you two could pay for your hides. He was exactly the sort who'd forget all about a female's presence whenever he didn't have any specific use for her, just as if she didn't exist or couldn't do something about the situation.
You forgot something.
Her voice actually surprised him as though it had suddenly come from nowhere. The man's startled gaze swung around and then down to her. That slight movement was echoed in his torso, turning it toward her. That opened up just enough of an angle for Neela to dig the points of her elbows into the ground, plant one boot sole flat with her leg bent, and straighten the other leg into a kick straight to the man's crotch. The look in his eyes showed that he was fully aware of her now. The man went down, falling heavily on his side. Boba Fett snatched up his blaster and, without taking time to aim, laid down a quick series of shots that stitched the ground close to the other figure, now rolling shoulder first into a sandy hollow. His return fire, desperate and inaccurate, was still enough to drive Fett back toward the rocky hillside. In here! Dengar grabbed Neela's forearm and pulled her into the safety of the shallow cave. He pushed her behind himself, then grabbed the blaster rifle that had been propped against the side of the opening. He braced the weapon against himself and started firing. The shots forced the other man's head below the lip of his shelter, giving Boba Fett enough time to break off his own fire and sprint back hunched low to his companions. From inside the cave, Neela and the two bounty hunters heard the raised voice of the man outside.
Fedrai! Get in on this! Now!
His partner, who must have been watching everything all along, now directed a hot fusillade their way from an angle that gave him a clear shot into the cave's mouth. Boba Fett fired back as all three of them retreated farther inside.
Now what?
Neela looked around the rough-hewn rock as the barrage of blaster fire lit up the space. Both Fett and Dengar had their spines planted against opposite walls of the cave, leaning forward just enough to get off a few quick shots before snapping their heads back from the bolts that sizzled past them.
We're stuck here. This hole doesn't go anywhere.
Hold your fire,
Fett instructed Dengar.
But they come in closer.
Dengar used the rifle muzzle to point outside. The one that was out in the dunes, he's moved up. He's got an even better angle now.
That's all right. I want the two of them together. Or close enough.
Why?
Dengar looked puzzled.
You think you can take both of them out?
I can cover you if you want to take a shot at it.
That won't be necessary.
The flashes from the weapons outside were enough for Neela to tell that Dengar was correct. The two besiegers were now within a couple of meters of each other, crouching down behind a shallow lip of rock. From there, they would be able to fire straight into the cave.
Don't bother trying to talk to him.
Neela nodded toward Boba Fett.
He's so far gone, he can't tell when there's no way.
A sudden noise interrupted her. From above, as though the night itself had split open, the sound grew from a distant shriek to a roar. The encircled sand dunes were lit up as though by the fall of Tatooine's twin suns. Beyond the cave's mouth, the two other figures were visible, turning onto their sides and raising their outspread hands, trying to ward off the weight rushing down toward them. All that happened in a few seconds, from the first whisper and bare glow to the half-rounded shape that appeared just above the desert floor, balanced on the fiery column of its landing engines. One of the two men was able to scramble to his feet and run, making a final dive headlong that took him beyond the quickly braked impact of the ship. The other managed only to get to his knees, blaster rifle pressed into the sand beneath his palm. Then the tail of the craft, nozzles blackened and still hot, crushed him flat. Dengar's voice broke the silence, the thrusting roar replaced by the glassy crackle of the molten sand cooling.
It's your ship. It's the Slave One.
Neela realized what had happened.
He got through, she thought, on the comm unit.
The link between the gear inside his helmet, the small transceiver antenna mounted at the side, and the equipment that Dengar had fetched back from the Mos Eisley spaceport, Boba Fett must have gotten that up and running just before the other two men had shown up.
Come on. Boba Fett moved toward the cave's opening. Let's get going. There's no reason to hang around here.
Neela didn't know whether he had been speaking to both of them or just to Dengar, but she wasn't taking any chances. She let the two men go before her at a quick sprint toward the Slave One ship. From the darkness of the surrounding dunes, a volley of laser bolts scorched the sand at their feet. The other besieger hadn't given up yet. Neela didn't let that stop her from following after Boba Fett and Dengar and quickly scooping up the dead man's blaster rifle as she ran.
Hold it!
At the hatchway of the ship, Neela raised the weapon, her thumb at its firing stud.
Stop right there!
Dengar was already inside, with one gloved hand grasping the side of the hatch. Boba Fett turned and looked over his shoulder, his visored gaze meeting that of the blaster rifle's muzzle.
You're not going anywhere without me, said Neela coldly.
Boba Fett's hand shot out before she could react, the motion faster than her eye could perceive. His fist locked onto the rifle barrel. With a quick twist of his arm, he had wrenched it out of her grasp. The weapon went spinning through the air as he flung it away. They stood looking at each other for a moment. Then Boba Fett reached down and grabbed Neela's wrist and pulled her up toward the hatchway.
Don't be stupid.
Fett's grasp tightened, squeezing the bones together.
I'm the one who decides who goes and who stays, and right now you're too valuable a piece of merchandise to leave behind.
A second later, she was inside the ship.
Brace yourself, said Fett, as he headed for a metal ladder at the side of the space. We're leaving now.
Neela rubbed her aching wrist. As she looked about herself at the bleak metal bars of the cages, she realized, though she didn't know when, what part of her shrouded past, that she had been here before. He hated to do it, but Bossk knew he had to. The greed impulses in his Trandoshan brain, as hardwired as any droid circuits, almost overruled all the others. He could hear the words inside his head, ancient bounty hunter wisdom, told to him by his own father.
The live ones are worth more than the dead ones.
Old Kradosk had known what he was talking about, at least about that. But even so, another truth remained, equally hard and obdurate.
Things were different when you were dealing with a creature like Boba Fett.
On the screen of the Houndstooth's long-distance scanner in the cramped cockpit, Boss could see the tiny speck of light that represented Fett's ship. The Slave One had already left the surface of Tatooine. No time for rethinking his decisions or regretting lost profits. Bossk had been back aboard Slave One, extracting a few more interesting files from its data bank when the comm controls had lit up. That could mean only one thing, that the message about Boba Fett being alive was true, and that he had just reinitiated contact with the ship. Bossk had also known what was to come. Slave One would obediently follow Boba Fett's remote-transmitted command, switch on and prime its engines, and head down to Tatooine to rendezvous with its master. And then Boba Fett would not only be alive, but free and active, and the top number one bounty hunter on all the galaxy's scattered worlds. Bosk could still feel the rage and fear that had come boiling up inside him. Rage was a familiar emotion. Trandoshans woke up angry, but fear was something new and powerful. It had pushed him into action, quick and efficient. He hadn't wasted any thought on the mysteries that had been so tantalizingly uncovered to him. If the rich and powerful Kuat of Kuat was interested in Boba Fett being alive or dead, so be it. Bosk might still be able to cash in by confirming it to the owner of Kuat Drive Yards. And if there was some connection between Prince Shizor, the Black Sun's hidden ruler, and the raid on the moisture farm at the Dune Sea's edge, the answers about that weren't going to come from Boba Fett. Bosk would make sure of that. There had been just enough time to haul a sufficient quantity of high thermal explosives over from the Houndstooth, conceal them in the holding cages of Fett's ship, and rig the remote triggering device. Then Bosk had sealed the entrance hatchway of Slave One, disconnected his own ship, and watched from his cockpit viewport as the other craft had sped planetward. Now that ship was heading back into space, bearing its helmeted master. The speck of light had grown larger. Another second and Bosk would have waited too long. All regret was expunged from his heart. He pressed the button on the cockpit's control panel. Instantaneously, the ominous light was transformed into a ball of churning flame, surrounded by extinguishing vacuum. Radiant sparks, bits of heated metal no bigger than a human's hand, drifted away from the core of the explosion. The dust and atoms of the other ship. Bosk leaned back in the pilot's chair, feeling exhausted as the tension began to drain from his coiled muscles.
That does it, he thought with relief. Boba Fett's dead now, for good.
No regrets. He knew it had to be done. But one thing still puzzled Bosk as he gazed out at the emptiness between the stars.
Why did he still feel afraid?
This is Anthony Heald. We hope you have enjoyed this production of Star Wars: The Mandalorian Armor, Book 1 of the Bounty Hunter Wars Trilogy by K.W. Jeter. This program was produced by David Rapkin and directed by Lars Howell, abridgment by Sharon Matlin. The Mandalorian Armor is a production of Lucasfilm Limited, copyright 1998, all rights reserved. The book The Mandalorian Armor is available wherever Bantam books are sold.